just like is going on now. We haven't quit in about 100 years.
So what Indians were these, sir?
Huh?
Do you remember which Indians? Plains Indians?
It's Plains Indians. It was the Plains Indians in Oklahoma. And Kansas, both. He served out his time with the Department of the government there, the Commissary Department, and the railroads were to be built into Oklahoma. So he got work and contracted some from on the of the work on the road that went from Fort Sill to Larned, Kansas. And of course, when the railroads were completed, he heard a great deal about Texas from the cowboys who came on up to Dodge and places where the railroads were already in. So he followed back, came back with a bunch of them.
The cowboys?
Yeah.
What did he hear about Texas that he liked? That there was a lot of land? Or?
I think that he thought that there was a greater future in Texas than there was in Kansas or Oklahoma or the West, for that matter, because there was, at that time, there's a great deal of bickering going on between the settlers that were drifting west, some from the south and some from the north, and they all carried their grudges with them, and it was not a pleasant thing when added to the troubles that the Indians had.
So good.
And so he thought that Texas, being a big country, would offer a more opportunity, and that to be further away from the war zone, and that he would like it better.
Yeah.
And so he came to Victoria, and my mother and her kinfolks were on their way to California. At the time that that they started for California, the Indians were giving lots of trouble on the plains.
Now, what year was this? He came to
I have no idea what year exactly that that the Fitzgeralds came to Victoria. It was at a period when before the railroads had entered into into Kansas and Oklahoma. The folks were from South Ireland. They were from Clifton, Ireland. And there were seven brothers of the Fitzgerald family that came over to this country.
And you know the reason they came over? Was it, or what, in what year?
Around the in early 50s.
Early 1850s?
Yeah. Potatoes didn't grow very good over there. For a few years they had a potato famine over there. And then too, one of my mother's forebears had been Sir Edwin Fitzgerald, and he had led an Irish a rebellion called the United Irish, and as usual, the Irish got licked, and the English were very magnanimous with them, and they told them that they could stay there in Ireland and stay on the old lands that they owned, provided they paid the rent promptly. And it seemed that they, being a very freedom-loving people, why they preferred the poverty that they would bring to America to the opportunity of living in their ancestral homes over there and paying rent on them.
So now, was it your mother's grandfather who came over?
My mother's uncles came over.
Oh. Well, our father came over too, right?
Yeah. Okay. My uncle and my father all came over. And then her mother died, and she still was with the Fitzgerald family, and they were on their way to California when they stopped at Victoria. Part of them stopped there, and part of them went on to California. And my father made the wagons for the ones that went on to California.
And he was working at Victoria then?
Yeah. So,
how big was Victoria then, do you know?
Wasn't much.
There were
others there who had, whose people had had the same fate that the Fitzgeralds had suffered, and they had a good deal in common to talk about it. And that was hard luck. My mother's family that she lived with, they were cousins of hers, both the father and the mother of this family were candy makers, and they were very successful candy makers, made a good living at it, and...
What kind of candy?
They made almost any kind of candy that was desired, from stick candy to taffy types and so forth.
They use some.
And Mr. Louis Fritz, and there's not an old timer alive that ever thought that his trip to Victoria was complete without bringing home some Fritz candy.
And this is in what years?
And Mr. Fritz learned his candy making from Mr. Fitzgerald.
Who's your uncle or your
He was
great
a cousin.
Uncle? Oh, I see.
He was a cousin of mother. And mother living with them met my father. I guess he was hanging around the candy store. and they fell in love and got married, and father thought he could make more money farming. Cotton was high and so forth, and he went down to a little town called Annapolis and tried his luck down there. And he didn't know about how high the rivers could get and how much rain could fall in the areas and how little one man could do. But he soon found out that one-man farms were very unprofitable.
They were the general rule, or was it the land he had?
Huh?
As a general rule, or the land he had that
was? That was a general rule. If you had to have lots of help, you had to chop your cotton and plant it.
Did they use black labor?
Labor was very hard to get in those times.
What did they use, something like freed slaves, or?
They
not many around?
There wasn't any. The most of the slaves that were either had left the farms or had gone into the town where they could live a little easier than they could. They had had all they wanted to farm for themselves.
Yes, sir.
So he decided to go back to making wagons and buggies, and he thought Golad being a frontier town and being an educational center. At that time, it was quite an educational center. Judge Brooks, that Brooks County is named for, that Johns Clayburgh County had a school there that he was the head of.
Well, was it a elementary school or a?
No, it was a It was a college.
College?
Yeah.
Oh, do you remember the name of it?
Brooks College.
Oh. Did your father attend classes there ever, or did you? Or?
No, my father had very little education. He, of course, running away from home at 12 years old, had very few years of schooling. But he was a natural mathematician, and he said if you had to take a pencil to figure anything out, you was making a bad trade. And he could figure in his head how he did it, nobody knows, but the answers were always right after you figured it out. He had his own method.
Yeah. And so he moved back.
So he moved to Golad and went into the wagon and buggy business. And the having borrowed $250 from the old bank that was there at Goliad, which was the Metzi and Levi and Pettis.
Yeah, that was in 1886 that he went to Goliad.
No, that was in 71 or 2.
1871 or 2. So you weren't born yet.
I wasn't born.
No.
When the railroad came about 96,
mm-hmm.
and we quit making wagons and buggies. I myself worked in the shop mm-hmm. before I was a teenager, taking bolts out of buggy wheels and replacing them after tires were set,
mm-hmm.
and holding the mules and horses while the smiths shod them. And by the way, they only got 50 cents for shoeing a horse for a pair of shoes in those days.
Four shoes, or they shod?
Two shoes.
They shod the front feet, or?
The front feet, yeah.
Oh, I see.
And frequently people shod a horse, especially a buggy horse, all the way around. Those four shoes. A cow horse, well, a lot of times they would only just put on the front
shoes.
Front.
Do you know why that is? Or?
Well, they put a slight cork, and the cork was meant that you turned a little part of the shoe down to a 45 degree angle. So that horse could stop easily, its foot didn't slip.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I understand.
And of course, lots of the animals were rather vicious. You had to put twisters on their nose to keep them from biting the rear end out of the horseshoe.
Your father never got hurt by any of the horses, did he?
No. And buggy tires were set for 50 cents, and 16 bolts were put in the tires for 15 cents. We all earned our money in those days, but we didn't have to go anywhere like Bonfield's. He has to do now that he has to jump in the car and run somewhere to see somebody, generally about nothing.
Well, now, what did y'all do for entertainment?
Huh?
When you were around 10?
Around 10, I went, we had lots of fun. We had flew kites and that may sound like a very prosaic thing to do, but we would break up bottles and take very slender pieces of limbs or anything that were very light, and we would wrap the pieces of glass between two pieces of this light material, and they would be about possibly 18 to 24 inches long, and that would be on the end of your kite tail, and you'd try to cut the other fellow's kite string with that.
Oh.
And it was an engaging thing. He was trying to dodge you or cut your kite, so you'd lose your kite. And so we had a lot of fun as kids doing that. Then we went swimming, and we played baseball in a fashion. You would be very much surprised when we hear people now saying they haven't cut the weeds in the park next door to us. We went out and we took our axe with us and we cut the little brush off of it, and we took a hand scythe and cut the weeds
ourselves.
And we played ball. We played ball and thought we was having a good time. And we had a rock for first or second base or wherever it was, not a padded bag. So there was all kind of things to do. Hunting was good. There was lots of game to hunt.
Rabbits and deer? Or?
Well, it was, of course, I never hunted rabbits except with a dog. But there was ducks and geese and of course, there was deer, but the kids hardly ever went deer hunting.
Oh, I see.
They went bird hunting, and they generally had a single barrel shotgun, and they shot with black powder, and they didn't know what smokeless powder hardly was, and at the time that I was shooting, and it was very cheap, about 2 cents a card, about 2 cents a shell, and generally you didn't miss many. You put it on him at 2 cents because that was a lot of money to a kid.
What about schooling then?
Huh?
What kind of school did you have?
We had school was went to the 10th grade. And we played a type of rugby football at school. We kicked the thing, had a line, we get it over the line. We didn't have rugby rules, we just were supposed to kick it on the other fellow's side, kick it over there and play on his side. And I don't know how the points were arranged, it was just mostly exercise, more than it was anything else. A lot of running, a lot of kicking and a lot of sore shins. It was all funny. They was all the little boys were tough anyhow. And we didn't have the boys just ahead of me didn't know what it was to have a pencil tablet. They had slates. And we had one teacher there named Miss Missouri Shive that had a very high temper. And those old big old boys, whether he was a city boy or a country, didn't make any difference to her. She would reach over and get a slate, and he'd be looking out of that slate frame first thing he knew, with pieces of slate hanging all around, and he looked like a mule looking out of tin barn. And
well, was it all the grades mixed in together in one room?
They'd have about four grades together. The rooms were reasonably large, and I suppose that the average teacher had between 50 and 60 pupils.
Like some of our college classes.
Huh?
Like some of our college classes.
Yeah. It was school was, and the bigger boys, when the school was over, that someone had always matched a fight by that time for the afternoon, and so you had a go off down behind some brush pile somewhere where the people wouldn't stop to fight, and all the kids would get around, and the two participants would fight very vigorously, you know, and wouldn't be mad at each other much. They just had to get rid of the energy that was in them. See that busted knuckle on that damn hand there?
Yeah, what'd you do there?
Well, because it was all of my foot.
Oh. So you did your share of fighting, huh?
No, I don't know. I got my share of black eyes, let's put it that way. dances, they had dances, and they had a Mexican string band, which was famous all through Refugio, Golad, Beville.
What was her name?
Named Polito's Band. And his name was Paris, Polito Paris. There's lots of the Paris family living up there now. And
what kind of music would they play?
Good music. Boy, they could play La Paloma or anything. Make tears run down your eyes.
Did y'all square dance? Square dance?
No. The waltz, two-step, something similar to it. But waltzes were the most popular of the...
This is in the early 1900s?
Early 1900s, yeah.
The old
Mexican, old Grandpa Paris, would go to sleep playing, and he'd play right along with the rest of them with his head wobbled over and fall out of his chair for now, but he'd keep time right with them.
So they'd play like Spanish music.
Yeah. Now lots of the people would hardly realize this. But when the Spanish came in and had the missions around Golad there, which it was free, they taught those Indians to play. Some of them were real good musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was surprising. And some of them were real good language. They spoke Spanish as well as a Spaniard, and they spoke the Indian lingos too, of which there was several different tribes of Indians in there. There was the Lipans and the Comanches and the Nicaraguas and the Tonkawas. Another one that I can't think of the name of now, that was more peaceful than the Tonkawas and the Karankawas. They were pretty bad boys.
You remember the people around you telling stories about the Indians?
Oh,
about your people?
Oh, plenty of them, yes. Plenty.
I remember Mrs. Williams told you about the Indians.
Mrs. Williams, who lived down in Victoria County, and what was in those days called the Fleming Prairie, she had a very exciting experience. The Indians in the made a raid in there in the 40s. And they killed her father, and she saw him scalping, and she had hid herself, and they looked around for her, but she had hidden so well that they didn't find her. And she was a very close friend of our family, and she gave me the first horse I ever had. And
how old were you?
I imagine about 10 years old. She had three children, Mary Williams and Mr. Simmons, a very very wonderful man. That later I went up to the Carville country, and Mr. Rob Williams, who also went to the Carville country, and one of the other brothers married a Stoner, who is a relative of Ms. Thomas O'Connor, that we know so well, that restored the mission to Goliad.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I remember you talking about there was a real bad drought the year that your father died. Remember that?
Yeah.
That was in what?
And we had a real bad drought in 17.
1917.
We had 3 years of drought. Part of the county, the north, the San Antonio River seemed to be the dividing line. It hardly rained north of the river. Just practically just like it was preordained that it wouldn't cross over that river. Then in 17, she crossed over. Covered the whole county and covered a whole lot of Texas.
Wait, this is a drought that extended. I see.
And in 18, it was 3 years. And that same drought affected this country here at
New Aces.
Corpus Christi, New Aces, and San Patricio, and Kingsville country down there as well. And I saw at Goliad endless people moving with their implements and their milk cow and everything else just stacked on their wagons and so forth, just like pioneers going to California.
They were
hunting water. They were hunting the place where, you see, when it gets dry down here, we have no creeks that you can water your animals in. You're almost paralyzed if you have livestock without you have water that you can get them to. But New Aces County, as the farms out here, had no water. They depended on rains to fill their tanks. They had to haul drinking water even to the farms. And you take that's living in a pretty sad way.
A lot of cattle died?
They didn't have so many guys. The cattle could be moved to other areas, and there wasn't so many cattle died because you could move them east or you could get something to prop them up with. And that's what I did. I went down and got big stacks of old rice straw that had been piled up for years for no sale around El Campo and Ferber and El Maiden and Blessing and so forth, and shipped that rice straw all over South Texas. There was nothing else to sell. Man had to have something to. And when he gave that old guy a bale of rice straw, he was only promising her that he was keeping her intestines from sticking together because she wasn't getting much good out of it.
But she's getting sun moisture.
Yeah, she was just getting hope, but that's all.
So you
make it another day, girl.
So you were shipping that around? How old were you then?
Oh, at 17, I was 31 years old.
Yeah. And then in 1922, you came yourself to Corpus Christi.
Came to Corpus in 1922.
And would you like to?
And
you wanted to come to Corpus?
I came to Corpus Christi from Goliad, where my father had established a business there, and because I had two younger brothers, and they were 10 and 12 years younger than I, and and I had a lot more experience naturally than they did. So it felt like that it would be to the advantage of the family if I used my experience, which would take no money, and got a job. So I got the job of managing the New Aces Hardware Company for the Plato interests. Do you want me to describe that?
Well, I was just, what did you first think of when you first came to Corpus Christi? What did it look like? This is in 22.
When I first came to Corpus Christi, the town itself was just recovering from a terrible storm of 1919.
That's right.
And it was my second attempt to come to Corpus Christi. The International Harvester Company had asked me the International Harvester Company on September 1919 had asked me to come down to Corpus and take over the old P&O Plow Company business that they had purchased here. And they were going to convert it into the international line. And of course, having been raised in the implement business, I told them that, and having gone through the serious trials that had fallen on us, and then we had been, that was in 19. And so I told them that the firm at W. Nealon and Sons at Golan could not underwrite a new business in Corpus Christi. And they said, well, don't worry about that. Said, the harvester company's got plenty of money. And I said, yeah, but they got plenty of money, but that don't do me any good. And so Mr. McWhirter and Mr. Ryan and Ed Tidmore, who was a traveling agent for them in this territory, we met in Houston. And the refugees of the 1919 storm were pouring into the hotels down there, and the terrible tales that we were hearing about our corpus washed away kind of gave me a scare. It should not have done so, but because my trade would have been more with the farmer than it would with the townspeople. But anyhow, I said, I'll go look at it. And when I came down here and looked at it, and I told them that it looked like a bunch of match piles that were just lumber all piled up, and it was terrible to look at the downtown. And they said, well, don't worry about that. You're going to sell the implements to the country, and there's just as much black dirt out there as it was before the storm. And I said, well, it's going to be pretty hard. And they said, well, we'll exchange you $200,000 in credit. And so I said, well, I got to talk this over. This thing's all taking a new look. And so it was just that bad that you felt like everybody certainly must be disheartened at the terrible wreckage that's everywhere. The wind had battered the homes up that weren't torn down by the storm. And one can never imagine any more destruction than happened to these people, with all the cottages and everything wiped off of North Beach. Mm-hmm. Just almost one house standing out there, which was the MacDonald House and a part of the Old Spawn Sanitarium. And Mr. MacDonald was a lawyer, and he had a barrel of whiskey in his garage, and his wife had a piano and everything downstairs, and they were all upstairs during the storm, and she come down and she found her piano all ruined with the water. And so she took Mr. MacDonald to task and said, "Where am I going to get a new piano?" He said, "Well, you can get a new piano most anywhere," he said, "but this was that prohibition is on. Where am I going to get another barrel of whiskey?"
They were still making pianos, but they'd stopped making whiskey, huh?
You can imagine the dilemma that faced people by the conflicting desires of this one family.
Well, how many people do you think were left in Corpus after?
After I came down here then in 22, why, 2 years later, mm-hmm. That would be in 24, we regained the population that Corpus Christi had in 1990.
Mm. So, why do you think that was? Because everybody came back, or what was?
No, there were new people coming in, and a lot of them never did come back. They had reasons. Lots of them had lost loved ones. Mm. They had lost their taste for storms. Some of them. I went to higher countries. San Antonio was a principal beneficiary of the population shift. San Antonio was pretty prosperous in that period. They could get work or investments or whatever they wanted in San Antonio. And they possibly would have made more money if they'd have stayed here and invested than they did if going up there. But that's a story that can never be unraveled. So our city has continued to grow, and about every 10 years for a long time, we doubled in population. We go from 10 to 25, and from 25 to 50. And from 50 to 100. And of course, as you begin to get up, then you begin to you begin to get slower, then, you know, your ratio was going against you. But there was more people actually coming than there was in the previous year, but your ratio wasn't so great. So Corpus had many things to attract people. The fishing down here was exceptionally good,
they were still taking oysters then. Huh? They were still taking oysters.
They were still taking oysters from Nueces Bay, and of course that was later discontinued on account of the necessity for the sewage dumping into the bay over there, which was supposedly not to be detrimental. It was supposed to be cured and cleansed and so forth, but...
When did they start dumping the sewage?
Huh?
When did they start dumping the sewage?
It was after the ship channel was completed. I would say around about 1926 or 7, along in there, that they when they finished that channel. You see, they had the first channel in did not extend on up like it does now. They had a turning basin and the affluent was dropped in behind that turning basin. And then when they dug the channel, that was another story. They had to go another way. And we had a shortage of water, and after we got going as a port here, we didn't have sufficient water. A Barnstall Refining Company came in, established a refinery on Nueces Bay Boulevard, and I worked with them very closely, and we couldn't get the water that they needed, and we made a trade with the city that we would take this treated water and pump it up to the Barnstall refinery for their boilers, and would use it up there. We were that short of water. I hope that our guides and looking forward for the future growth of this city will be wise enough to provide the water that is going to be required if we're going to be a happy people. You can't do it on short water.
There we go.
When we moved to Corpus Christi, we rented a house on Blucher Street. Mm-hmm. And Blucher Street, of course, was in walking distance of my work down at the Nueces Hardware Company. And people were not ashamed in those days to walk to work. I think we may come to that again, but we had a great stream of people that passed our home early in the morning that were going down to the two shrimp houses that were engaged in canning shrimp down at the, they were, it was an extension of Cooper Street that extended out into the bay, and it was a wharf, we call a wharf. Mm-hmm. And the boat that came in here most frequently was called the Rotarian, and it carried freight to Houston and from the area around Houston. The shrimp plants had to can the shrimp because there was no method of shipping shrimp. We didn't have planes going out with ice shrimp, or we didn't have other methods of disposing of the frozen shrimp like we have today. It could freeze.
Was the railroad down here then?
But
no refrigerated cars.
Yeah. The railroad that had extended out there had in the earlier days been used for bringing lumber in. Lots of the lumber that came in was from Florida and Georgia. Which it was all called Florida lumber, but it was wonderful lumber and a very unusually fine grade of lumber because it had never been tapped for turpentine, and the natural elements that were preservative in the inherent quality of that hard type lumber was still intact. It had never been deleted from the original sources of that the tree stored up its own protectiveness with. Down at the corner of Cooper Street, there was an old house there that was built by one of the early Irish settlers. And
is that still standing?
No.
It's gone.
They had a big dance and went ahead with all the festivities that went with the marriages in those days, and somehow the house burned down, and then that the burning of that house was the signal for the organization in the early days of the first firefighting equipment into Corpus Christi.
About what year was that?
I couldn't tell you.
It was in the 20s, though?
Huh?
Was it in the 20s?
No, it... I would guess it was somewhere in the... around 18, you mean around, it was...
Oh, was it 1800s?
Yeah.
Oh, before you came.
Before I came.
Oh, I see.
And that site of that house is where we have our buildings today.
Fire department buildings?
No, the house that burned down that caused them to organize the fire department.
Oh. Oh, your building?
Yeah.
I see, the Neyland building.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Did you buy the land then?
Did you buy
it? No, I didn't buy it then.
Oh, I see.
It belonged to the Rogers family.
You weren't here then.
I wasn't here then. But...
I was going to ask you if you had been in the past.
To go back into the early eras of the people that first come in and to the organization of the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
They built a little piers out into the bay, and the fire wagon cart was drawn by men, and they would run these carts out in out over these piers, and then they would unroll the hose as they came back and to fight the fire, and they would pump the water from the bay to fight the fire.
Was that hose?
I have pictures of the old Corpus Christi with the names of the houses, names of the people who owned the houses, and also the piers which were used for fire purposes, and also the piers for bathing purposes. They differentiated by the piers for the bathing purposes had little covers over them, little housing on them, you know, where you could dress and undress. And of course the fire piers had just plain vanilla, and you did nothing on them but the boards to get the cart out. I thought you might like to have
that was
description in there, because some people didn't know how they fought the fires yet. Didn't know maybe they fought them. They just set them. And when they put the new Midtown Expressway in several years ago, they run into an earthen, rather a receptacle down there that was made to store fresh water in, and it was supposed to be connected with Kinney's trading post, which was nearby. And they the material and the cement and the aging of all of that underground had just been something that had worked together. They couldn't tear that thing apart hardly with modern machinery. It was really, really something. So I'll close that part of the early stuff that we had talked about there, and that you wanted to know about what some of the people did in those days, you know. And I talked at the question of the firefighting, which of course was very necessary, and you see that Corpus Christi had no water.
No, no. Fresh
water. The water was hauled in carts, Mexican carts, two-wheel carts.
Two wheels. Oh.
And brought from out on to the west of town. There were some wells out there that were had sweet water in them, and they would deliver that drinking water to you.
And what did it cost?
I have no idea what
but you had to pay. Did each homeowner have to pay for his own water?
He just bought how much water he wanted.
Now, what was early business like? You worked in a hardware store, managed a hardware store.
Okay. The businessmen of Corpus Christi, the principal ones at that time,
In the 20s,
was the Lichtenstein store for dry goods, Guggenheim store that had been at the corner of Peoples and Chaparral, had a fire, and they had just quit, and then they still had a great influence here in Corpus. And quite rightfully so. Mr. Guggenheim was a wonderful citizen, and so was his partner, Mr. Cohn. And Mr. Cohn had died, and Mr. Mr. Guggenheim did not want to go back in business, and Mr. Cohn's son, Joe Cohn, had taken up a law course and didn't seem to care for the dry goods business, although he later went into it, but not with Mr. Guggenheim. The other store was a big store was Edson's, and that was E-I-D-S-O-N-S. And there were two Edson brothers. One of them had a big store over at Del Rio. What's the other store on the river? I was in the Del Rio area, just across the river from Mexico. Together they bought a larger quantities than they could have bought if they had one store. The grocery business was covered by Wild Brothers, who had a real fine store, and by cut off by Mr. Harris. And groceries were sold, believe it or not, where you paid your bill once a year.
They were pretty trusting.
Yeah.
How much would a year's groceries be, you remember?
That depend on
how much you ate.
How many kids you had. But it was, groceries were cheap anyhow in those days, considering everything. Mr. Harris specialized more with the farm trade than the Wild Brothers did. And it was a successor of his that still continues on in the grocery business here and the wholesale business out on the Highway 9, San Antonio. They were a very fine family and beloved by every farmer, and should have been.
It's your story. You sold farm implements.
Yes, ma'am.
Who took care of things like seed and fertilizer? Did you sell any of that, or was that another story?
There was very little fertilizer. In fact, there was no fertilizer that I know of that was sold in Nueces County in the 20s, because this land was all new, just being put into cultivation, and was rich in minerals and other plant nutrients that could be. And it was of course, this black land is it comes from decaying limestone. And it is a sweet soil. And after a rain, if you walk out into a field, you still see little traces of the limestone that washed down. There'll be little minute granules of it from the size of a pea down to nothing. But you can see it readily after a rain, and with the soil wet and the little pebbles getting a bath, why, they're much more visible than they would be otherwise.
What is that plant then?
Huh?
What was the main crop then?
The main crop then was cotton. And it was farmed with mules, no tractors. And
so you just sold plows. You didn't sell any like mechanical.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
It was an era of change, and the big change came when we got a two-row horse-drawn equipment. We thought we had made a big step forward.
When was that?
Huh?
When'd you get that?
And that was in 24. Might have sold a few in late 23. But in 24, there was lots of two-horse equipment, two-row equipment sold. And it did a good job. That is, in cotton. The maize came into the play. And since we could raise more maize per acre than we raised by, could raise corn, it was more dependable and would wait for a rain a little longer than corn would. Why, the farmers all used maize. And they used a row binder and cut the entire stalk of maize, which was not a dwarf maize in those days. It was a taller maize, and you carried that maize to the barn, and you stacked it with the heads on the inside. You put the butts on the outside, and the heads to the inside, and made your stacks to the width of two of the bundles of maize. And then that protected that maize from the elements by topping it off and laying your a single rows of tying them together with a single row of maize, and then putting a loose hay or other tarpaulin or anything over it so that those maize heads on the inside wouldn't catch the moisture. And they were usually tied down by some wire or some heavy article that would keep taut all time, so that the tarpaulin, if it was a tarpaulin, would remain with the weights on it and wouldn't blow away. Little of it, if any, was ever put into a barn. Then they took the maize and began heading it, and then thrashing the heads, and some time later, a very smart man up in the plains country saw a dwarf maize plant. And with a good head of seed on it that was only about half the height of the other maize. And he immediately recognized that as a potential for a change of in the methods of growing maize. And the A&M College joined with him, and they developed a species of maize from that one find of that one part of that, I believe they call it a spur variety, where it is entirely different from its parentage, you see. And you want to cut it? The change that came to our farms was largely the question of labor. It was such a necessity for getting your cotton picked quick, because you were running against always the fear that you would have a tornado of some kind in the fall of the year, and you wanted to get it out and have it picked by hand rather than picked by tornado. And so the race was always on, and farmers were bidding against one another for help. So it happened that if you ride by some of these old big farms, you still see house after house, a little bit of houses surrounding it. And that's they tried to get the Mexican families that they could get to come in here and do the work that had the biggest family. Because if he had a big family, you keep him there, you had a lot of
extra hands.
Help all the time, and you had to have a help. Now, in this era, we do it mechanically. And what once was a cheap labor has now taken advantage of the opportunities and I think done well with them, and speaks well for them that they have seen their opportunity and have done so much for themselves and for the country too, in taking educations and doing what they are doing. As many find Mexican people today whose parents come in here as peons.
Migrant workers.
And migrant workers. And it was a difficult job, and they come up, if there's anything lower than the rung on the ladder, why, first rung, why, he was it. He got nothing but hard deals.
How much did they pay him, say, in the 20s? Do you remember?
Not just exactly enough to pull it out.
Well, below a dollar a day, or?
No, about a dollar a day.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.